searching Skull Cottage, and the next my impulsive mouth had flung Dogger into some deep hell of the past. For someone like myself who is used to having her own way, there is nothing worse than the feeling of helplessness, of not knowing what to do. All I could think of was to touch the back of Dogger's neck. Perhaps the warmth of my fingers would calm his brain. I noticed, as I made contact, how neatly barbered he was. When had he got a haircut, and where, I wondered. I supposed he had been clean-shaven, back and front, for as long as I could remember. And yet I couldn't recall his ever visiting a barber. There was so much I didn't know about the man. At the touch of my hand, Dogger turned his head slowly round, looked up at me and smiled. Well, perhaps it wasn't quite a smile, but the corners of his eyes wrinkled slightly. "Thank you," he said. "I shall be all right in a few moments." "Shall we take a little stroll?" Claire suggested. "Over to my place. It's not far, just beyond the stile. I'll make a nice cup of tea. This place is not conducive," she added with a shiver. Even though I didn't know the meaning of the word, I knew what she meant. "Besides," she continued, "we don't want to be caught tampering with the evidence, do we?" I questioned the wisdom of having to move Dogger so soon after his turn. But wasn't Claire, after all, a nurse? Mustn't she have been accustomed to Dogger's episodes, and how best to deal with them? She was already helping Dogger out of the chair. "A stroll in the fresh air will do us all some good," Claire said, with a glance at me, and I felt a flush of shame arising. "It's such a lovely day," she added, opening the door. Outside, the sun had suddenly sprung up, as it does in midsummer, as if night had never existed. We stepped out onto the porch, and she turned the key in the lock. "What is it Houseman said about such beautiful summer weather? June suns, you cannot store them, to warm the winter's cold. I forget the rest." "The lad that hopes for heaven," Dogger said, "shall fill his mouth with mould." "Of course," Claire said. "Your memory always amazes me, Arthur." By now we were approaching the stile. I lifted down one of the cross-pieces, and we stepped over easily, without having to scramble across like a herd of schoolboys. We stopped for a few moments under the willows to admire a mute swan with its two cygnets, both of which were dabbling about in circles. "The mute swans belong to the king," Claire told us. "They're his personal property. At least, they did. Now they shall belong to the queen. How very odd it will seem to have a Queen Elizabeth on the throne again after 350 years. It's going to take some getting used to, I expect." A metallic clatter behind us made me turn round. Through the hanging branches I could see Skull Cottage and someone dismounting from a bicycle. "Shh," I said. "It's Constable Otter." "Just in the nick of time," said Claire. Chapter 17. Claire's cottage was everything Orlando's wasn't, neat, compact, and filled with the morning light. A pair of wing-backed chairs, upholstered in cheery chintz, faced the fireplace. Dogger, with deliberate movements, lowered himself into one of them, and I took the other. Claire made herself busy with the teapot and the kettle, setting out three cups and saucers on the blue-painted kitchen table. "Pleasant," Dogger remarked. I was happy to see that he seemed to be recovering himself. Having been exposed to his terrors in the past, I knew that they might be mild or severe, and of either short or horrifically long duration. At least this time he hadn't been haunted by visions. As Claire was pouring the tea, I had a sudden vision of my own, of the Rolls sitting parked in the field beyond Orlando's cottage. Before I could say anything, there came the clatter of boots on the porch, and an abrupt, official-sounding knock on the door. Claire seemed in no hurry to answer it. "Yes, Constable?" she asked. "Is there a problem?" Constable Otter made no secret that he was craning his neck to look past Claire to Dogger and me, who was still seated at the fireplace. "I wondered, miss," he said, "if you had noticed anyone about in the past 20 minutes or so." I knew perfectly well that he had spotted the rolls in the field, and had done as any good policeman would do, checked the temperature of the radiator. He had estimated the time based upon the cooling rate and the time of day, taking into consideration the outside temperature. Not bad, I thought. As I had noted before, young Otter was going places. No one other than my two guests, Constable. We're just sitting down to a cup of tea. Would you care to join us?
Not while I am on duty, thank you, Miss Tetlock, he said.
Constable Otter was definitely going places.
Anyone at Skull Cottage, I mean.
We walked through the property, I volunteered, on the way here. Careful, Flavia, I thought. Don't slice it too fine. We parked in the field beyond, I explained, hoping to shift attention from the cottage. With great ceremony and a few fancy flourishes, Constable Otter produced his little black book and made a note.
"Mr. Luce and Mr. Dogger," he said, pronouncing our names as he wrote them down, which seemed to satisfy him.
He closed his notebook and looked narrowly from one of us to the other. I recognized the technique. Was the constable trying to intimidate us, or simply to assert his authority? He turned as if to go, then paused and looked me in the eye.
"You seem to get about a good deal, Mr. Luce."
"We're on holiday," I replied, "trying to see as many of the sights as we can, yet remaining ready to hand, should you require us." That "ready to hand" and "require us" were both masterstrokes. They suggested availability and a willingness to please without actually fawning. Still, I mustn't risk being too clever with this man. But then he turned and was gone. Dogger, I realized, had said nothing during the constable's visit. I stared at him, wondering how he was feeling.
"Better, thank you," he said.
It was remarkable. Dogger and I were as attuned to each other as two wireless sets operating on a private frequency. At the same time, I could tell that he needed time to recuperate. It would be up to me to make good use of the meantime. "I must admit I'm curious," I said to Claire, who had come to stand behind Dogger. Although she appeared not to be, she, too, was keeping a close eye on him. "About the Three Graces, I mean."
"Ah, the Three Graces," she said. "Miss Willoughby, Miss Harcourt, and Miss Cray. Where did you hear about them?"
"Mrs. Dandyman at the circus told me about them. I didn't want to pry too much."
"Probably a wise choice," Claire remarked, and left it at that. "We should be happy to hear their story," Dogger said, settling back into his chair. This was an excellent sign, and I could see that Claire thought so too.
"Well," she began, "it all had to do with the church. St. Mildred's had just begun to drag itself out of the Middle Ages. For the first time since the creation, women were beginning to take on certain roles. Not ordination, to be sure, but important roles nevertheless."
"Such as vicar's warden," I said.
"Precisely. And as you can well imagine, because of the very novelty of these appointments, the competition to fill them was fierce. Until this time, Miss Willoughby, Miss Harcourt, and Miss Cray had been the greatest of friends, cronies you might have called them. They played bridge and euchre together. They took holidays together. They made up half of the Volsthorpe bitter knitters, as they called their little circle. Jokingly, of course. But as you know, a joke, in order to be effective, must be at least half true. And then there was the gossip.
It was said that those three had refined rumours into razor blades. There was nothing they didn't know and weren't willing to talk about, from the colour of any trout's knickers, which were said to be Venetian red, to the precise amount to the penny in little Albert Morrow's piggy bank, 2 shillings 4 pence halfpenny. But when the vicar's warden, dear old Dr. Glanley, died suddenly after catching a chill during a midnight house call, everything changed. It wasn't exactly open warfare, but it wasn't far from it. Oh, they were still polite enough to one another when they met, but it was as if each of them had mysteriously grown bristles. There were odd visits in odd hours to the vicarage, forgotten gloves, borrowed books, promised recipes, any pretext to get Canon Whitbread alone and press their case. "Who was it that called them the Three Graces?" I asked. Funnily enough, it was Canon Whitbread himself. Initially, I think, he tried to make light of the situation, but he finally realized that it was no joking matter. In the end, he said, he had to fall back on the wisdom of Solomon and let them take turns, a year for each in strict rotation. "And what about Mrs. Palmer?" I pressed. "She told me she was vicar's warden, too." "And so she was," Claire said, "although that happened a bit later, after Miss Cray came down with a severe colic." "Colic?" I asked. "I thought that was something babies got." "In adults," Dogger said, "it may, among other things, be caused by kidney stones or gallstones." I couldn't help shooting him a beaming smile. "At any rate," Claire went on, "Canon Whitbread ruled that rather than disrupt the business of the parish with temps, as they call them nowadays, a fourth volunteer be appointed to step in when any of the Three Graces, as he called them, was indisposed." "That doesn't make sense," I objected. "A fourth person serving part-time would be no less disruptive than one of the other three filling in." "That very point was raised at a meeting," Claire said, "but the canon pointed out that a temporary substitution, based upon the random bouts of illness in another, might result in an unjust division of duties." Or so he claimed. Frankly, I think he was not above inventing convenient excuses. The Three Graces had to pretend to be satisfied with that solution, and so Greta was allowed to join their company. "Greta?" I asked. "Greta Palmer, your present landlady." "Did anyone object to that?" I couldn't resist the question. "Oh, there was some grumbling, mostly among the Graces. There was the usual chin-wagging that Greta wasn't as good as she ought to be, that there was some past scandal that hadn't been properly aired." "And was there?" I interrupted. Claire paused and looked up toward the ceiling, as if to find an answer. "And of which of us is there not?" she asked finally. I had to admit she had a point. Even I, Flavia Deluce, have done certain things in the past of which I am not particularly proud, although I don't need to bother listing them here. "I suppose," I agreed, a little too weakly for my own liking. "Now then," Claire said, "I expect you're wanting me to get on with it, to get to the poisonings." "This woman knew me like the inside of her eyelids." I shrugged. "If you wish," I said, the best I could do on the spur of the moment. She laughed, not a laugh as of silvery bells, as you might expect, but a whole-hearted guffaw that grew from the gut and exploded into the room. Dogger smiled. Life had never been sweeter. "The poisonings," Claire said, as if she were reading aloud the title of a scientific paper at the beginning of a speech. "It was given in evidence at the trial of Canon Whitbread that on the morning of the murders he got out of bed and, having overslept, put on his vestments at the vicarage, rather than in the vestry of the church, as he usually did." "Was it a Sunday?" I asked. "Yes, it must have been. St. Mildred's has not conducted early communion services on a weekday for as long as I can remember, except on certain occasions. Such as when Christmas falls on a weekday or a Saturday, I said. Claire nodded and went on. He left the vicarage directly, without breakfast, as is usual for one about to partake in Holy Communion, and hurried across to the church. He was several minutes late, a fact which was later confirmed by members of the congregation. "Was Orlando living with his father at the time?" I asked. "As a matter of fact, he was," Claire said, although it was claimed by the Crown Prosecutor at Kin and Whitbread's trial that he had taken the 702 up to London the previous evening. "Hmm," I said. "I would need to look into this later," I thought. "Alibis involving railway timetables do not happen nearly as often in real life as they do in detective novels. Not that it much mattered now anyway, since Orlando was dead." Or did it? "Sorry," I said to Claire, "I was wool-gathering. Go ahead." Well, Kin and Whitbread began the service. The congregation was sparse, as it so often is on early summer mornings, no more than a handful of people. "Including the Three Graces, obviously," I said. "Obviously. None of them would ever dream of missing a service. Couldn't allow the other two to get one up on them. It might have been funny if it weren't so pitiful. Everything was quite normal right up to communion. Miss Willoughby, Miss Harcourt, and Miss Cray came up to the rail together. Kin and Whitbread administered the sacraments, and they returned to their pew." "The same pew?" I asked. "Oh, yes. They always sat together." "Who else?" I asked. "In the other pews, I mean." "Only three others. Lettice Farnsworth and her husband Hugo, and, oh yes, the undertaker's lad."
"Hob Nightingale?"
"Yes, that's right. The little lad. Sat in the front row out of habit. Anyway, it wasn't long, no more than a couple of minutes, before the Three Graces began dropping like flies. I'm sorry to put it so crudely, but that's how Lettice described it at the inquest." Lettice Farnsworth was to be congratulated. She had given a remarkably vivid and accurate description of cyanide poisoning. In its most lethal form, hydrocyanic acid, HCN, insufficient dosage, can kill within a minute. It does so by paralyzing the central nervous system, and, perhaps more important, by paralyzing the heart directly. It is always pleasant to reflect, also, that the same cyanogen is found in the kernels of peaches and cherries, and that the glucoside amygdalin, which is contained in the essential oil of bitter almonds, as well as in the kernels of plums and apricots, is converted into hydrogen cyanide in the presence of certain enzymes and a bit of moisture, and is often used to provide the characteristic taste and odor in the manufacture of certain sweets. Do I enthuse too much? Very well, then, I enthuse too much. The point is that, by dropping like flies, the Three Graces reacted exactly as I should have expected. "Mrs. Farnsworth didn't go up for communion herself?" I asked Claire. "No," Claire said. "She was made to sign the pledge with the Band of Hope, when she was a child, that liquor would never pass her lips." "Not even when it's the blood of our Lord Jesus Christ?" I asked. "Not even," Claire said, shaking her head. "What about her husband? What was his name? Hugo?" "Poor Hugo has had his struggles with alcohol, but he's been abstinent for years. He and Lettice go to church for reasons of their own, but when it comes to Holy Communion, they both sit on their hands." "It seems un-Anglican," I said. Claire laughed that laugh again. "Someone once said that all Roman Catholics are Roman Catholics for the same reason, but every Anglican is Anglican for reasons of their own." Dogger smiled. In spite of his silence, he was following our conversation intently. "Now then," Claire said, "let me get on with my story, and you can save your questions for later."
Had I just been put in my place?
If so, she had done it so gently that I could hardly take offence. I gave her a grin to show that there were no hard feelings. "Dropping like flies," I prompted. "Oh, yes, dropping like flies." Well, Kin and Whipred had returned what remained of the consecrated elements to the altar. Before they could finish the recital of the Lord's Prayer, the three graces were dead. How fascinating, I thought, that "feed on him in thy heart, and preserve thy body and soul unto everlasting life," would be the last words that the three graces would ever hear in this life before the cyanide froze their hearts and they were plummeted into eternity. But what could they have done to deserve so dire a death? "Hold on," I said. "One more question. Why would Canon Whipred poison three harmless old ladies? What was his motive?" "Well," Claire said, "it came out at his trial that there had been some jiggering of the church funds. Not a great deal, mind, but enough that the various vicars' wardens could no longer ignore it. They had decided to join together as a body. How apt," I thought, "in order to confront him." "Was Mrs. Palmer one of those?" Dogger had been sitting so quietly I'd almost forgotten he was in the room. "Yes," Claire answered. "They arranged to meet in the vestry. Kin and Whipred reportedly didn't take it very well." "All of this came out at the trial, I presume?" Dogger asked. "Yes, and most, but not all of it, was reported in the newspapers. The church still has long arms where certain interests are involved." Dogger nodded, satisfied, and subsided into his thoughts. "Now comes the interesting part," Claire went on, resuming her story. "After the three graces had collapsed into their pew, like circus contortionists, Lettice told me later, Ken and Whipred went on to the Gloria and the Blessing. He didn't come down from the altar until he had completed the service." "To give the cyanide time to work," I exclaimed. "He wanted to be certain they were dead." "So the Crown Prosecutor suggested at his trial. But the defense suggested, quite brilliantly, at least in this instance, that the older clergy had been taught to carry on, come hell or high water, as he put it, begging my lord's pardon, and citing the instance of the Vicar of Chittleford, who, despite a direct hit on the nave of his church during the Blitz, had gone on to the completion of Holy Communion, though not a single member of the congregation remained alive. The defense then, changing course slightly, began to put forward an argument for shock, but the judge was having none of it. In the case of the three graces, no one from the congregation had come to their assistance until it was too late. "The Farnsworths and Hobnightingale, you mean?" I said. "It wouldn't have mattered much if they had, unless they'd just happened to have three doses of the antidote to cyanide up their sleeves and got to the victims within seconds." "I suppose," Claire said, "but Lettice claimed that they hadn't really noticed anything untoward until Hope Harcourt slipped out of her pew and crumpled to the floor. It is not uncommon for elderly ladies to doze off at early morning services on warm summer mornings, not uncommon at all. Although they don't any more," she added. "Since the three graces died, it's believed bad luck to sit in that pew. Some say it's haunted. Some say you can still smell the poison." "Hold on," I said. "What about Hob? Did he see them fall?" "Hob didn't give direct evidence. He's underage. But he gave a statement to the police, saying that, since he was seated in front of the three victims, he would hardly have noticed anyway. Smart as a whip. A very clever thinker, or Hob is, for so young a lad." I realized that no matter how fascinating Claire's story might be, there were several things I needed to do at once. I could always catch up on the details later. "I'm sorry," I said, glancing at Dogger, "but I think it would be best if we got back to the Oak and Pheasant." Dogger, bless his finely tuned soul forever, nodded assent and began to get up out of his chair. "I wonder if I might trouble you to drive," I asked Claire. She scrambled to her feet and took Dogger's elbow, as if in friendship. "Of course," she said, and a few minutes later we were riding in comfort back toward the inn, with Claire at the wheel and Dogger beside her.
"I shouldn't feel right riding in the passenger compartment," Dogger had insisted. "First time I've ever driven a Rolls-Royce," Claire told us. "Actually, it's the first time I've ever ridden in one. I shall be spoiled forever."
I glanced over at Dogger, who was gazing out with seeming disinterest at the passing river bank. "I shall see you in, then take the shortcut home."
"No need," Dogger said. "I am quite all right. It was pleasant seeing you again, Claire."
He offered his hand and she took it. I'd swear that a look passed between them, but I couldn't be sure. My heart gave a little lollop. Had I been witness this morning to a carefully produced drama? Had Dogger staged an episode in order to be in the company of Claire Tetlock? Would Dogger even be capable of such a thing? There are times when eyes and ears are not enough, times when you need to go inside yourself, to listen to the whisperers in the pit, who, although they may sometimes shock you, are very seldom wrong. After seeing Dogger to the door and waving goodbye to Claire, I made a beeline across the road to St. Mildred's. I needed to be alone.
Chapter 18. The church, as I had hoped it would be, was empty. Inside, I made a slow circuit of the nave and the chancel, reading the ancient memorial marble tablets that seemed to cover every inch of the walls, and a grim old lot they were, most of them recalling in stifling detail the lives of military men back to the time of William Conker, as Mrs. Mullet referred to the tour operator, who had brought the Deluces to England in 1066. Everything was coated heavily with dust, some of it, I knew, the remains of those happy warriors and their loved ones, who must be jammed, judging by the number of plaques, heel to jowl, inside the walls and underneath the floor's stone slabs. You couldn't walk down the aisle without having Sir Morton Stackpole and Maud, his dearly beloved wife, rise up in a cloud to greet you, as if they had been too long without company, and settle in a chummy way on your hands, your face, your neck, and in your hair. On the epistle side of the church, just outside the chancel, let into the floor at the foot of the lectern, was a bit of stone, a grey-flecked square of marble, no more than 3.5 or 4 inches on each side. In the crumbling antiquity of the church, its relative lack of age had caught my eye. In short, to someone with my powers of observation, the marble stuck out like a sore thumb. Too new, too polished, too freshly chiselled. I got down on my hands and knees to examine the surface. On it, carved in half-inch letters, was the word G-L-O-W. Glow? What on earth could that mean? Could it possibly be a family name? I had never met or heard of anyone with the surname Glow, but in England such a thing is not beyond belief. Or was it, perhaps, a discreet marker placed by some organization, such as the General Labourers and Office Workers, to commemorate a certain occasion or a gift of money to one of the church funds? There was no point wasting time in speculation. I would simply ask the present vicar for an explanation. Clem, I believe Mr. Palmer had said his name was, the plump gentleman who had come to the river bank with Constable Otter. I made a second circuit, pausing this time to run my fingers along the back of the pew, the second row from the front, where I deduced from all accounts that the three graces must have met their end, or ends. There wasn't a trace left of their passing, which in a few cases can be remarkably messy, cyanide working as it occasionally does. If such was the case, someone had done a wizard job of mopping up.
I slid gently sideways into the pew, closed my eyes, clasped my hands, and tried to project myself into the past, into the minds of those three old ladies at the very moment the poison had taken hold. There would have been, at first, the realization that the sacramental wine was stronger than usual. Perhaps a cracked or otherwise defective cork, overlooked by Canon Whitbread, had allowed it to go sour, although I recalled from my chemical readings that in 1922 the Holy Office had given permission to the Archbishop of Tarragona, in Spain, for the sacramental wine to be treated with either sulfurous anhydride or potassium bisulfite to keep it from going off. That, of course, was the Roman Catholic Church, which is far more advanced in such matters than the Church of England. After that first taste, there would have been a couple of blissful moments which would, alas, be their last, and then the sudden onrush of sensations, the taste of bitterness, the burning in the throat and bowels, the tightening of the jaw, the foaming at the lips, the perspiration, the inability to move any of the muscles, not even time, probably, for a final uh-oh. How pleasant it is, as you sit in an ancient church, to ponder poisons, surrounded as you are by the towering toxicity of the stained glass windows. The yellow cloak of that staring saint, for instance, was most likely achieved by adding cadmium, which, with its several compounds, is quite poisonous, whereas the startling emerald green of all that glassy grass at Galilee is most likely due to arsenic. To say nothing of the lead. Such happy thoughts are proof that I have become an adult. I am now ruled by not only what I see, what I hear, what I taste, and what I smell, but also, and perhaps most important, by what I think. That very thought in itself ought to be certain proof that my brain has developed satisfactorily. Pleased with myself, I turn the attention of my expanding brain to my surroundings. Old churches, like old humans, give off occasional creaks and groans as bits of dried wood and old stones shift in their sockets. Also, like old humans, they tend to hum a bit, although it's nothing to be alarmed about. The slightly sickening smell of long-departed lilies and longer-departed perspiration hangs like an invisible mist in the air. There is an almost imperceptible whiff of roast beef, as if the ghosts of John Bull and his fellow squires were banqueting in the crypt. Added to this, almost as an afterthought, is the dry, pious odour of Bibles and hymnals. Why do the printers of these books use so sober-smelling an ink? Why don't they stare your nostrils and your imagination with the sharp, tantalizing stink of, say, the News of the World or the Daily Mirror? To verify this observation, I reached out and lifted a Bible from the book rack of the pew in front of me, and gave it a sniff. Slightly mouldy, but still recognizable as a Bible. I'd put money on being able to identify one in the dark. As is almost always the case, the book was bound in black, the title stamped in gold on the cover and spine. This particular edition contained not only the Bible, but also the complete Book of Common Prayer, along with maps of the Holy Land, charts of weights and coins of Scripture, and botany of the Bible, from which I was delighted to learn that the vine of Sodom in Deuteronomy is in fact a kind of giant milkweed with poisonous juice, which, in spite of its tasty appearance, dissolves, upon being bitten, into smoke and ashes. All of this in one handy, although slightly bulky, volume. It was a churchgoer's dream, a Boy Scout knife for Bible class. But something had caught my eye. The word poison had leapt at me off the page. Yes, here it was, Deuteronomy 32, verses 32 and 33. For their vine is of the vine of Sodom, and of the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of gall, their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of dragons and the cruel venom of asps. If I had stuck my finger at random into the Bible, as fortune-tellers do, I couldn't have hit upon a more apt entry. Wasn't this a direct warning against poisoned wine? Could the poison of dragons and the cruel venom of asps refer to gossip? Both passages were underlined in pencil. Scarcely daring to breathe, I turned slowly back to the flyleaf, almost afraid of what I might find. Written in black gall ink, the words made my eyes swim. Anne Elizabeth Cray, Hassock Cottage, Volsthorpe. "Annie Cray! Of the three graces, faith, hope, and treachery," Mrs. Dandyman had called them. And of the three, Annie Cray was treachery. Was it possible that she had brought this Bible to church the day of her murder, and that it had lain here unnoticed ever since? 2 years had passed since Annie and her fellow gossips had been trundled off to meet their maker. Could it be that the police, the whip-smart Constable Otter included, had overlooked the harmless Bible nestled in its book-rack, not 2 feet from where the dead women would have lain? Obviously it was. Hadn't Claire Tetlock told me that the pew was believed to be haunted, that no one would sit in the spot where I was sitting now? Besides, a Bible or a hymn-book is as invisible in a church as the walls and windows. No one would think to take a second look at the contents of the book-rack. It had lain there all this time, untouched, waiting for someone with the eyes to see. Waiting for me, Flavia Deluce. As I flipped the pages idly, the names of the books in the Old and New Testaments, the page numbers, as well as the numbers of the chapters and verses, fluttered by like those animated cartoons which you make by drawing, in the corner of each page with a pencil, a slightly different sketch of a galloping horse or a stick man having his hat blown off by the wind. I was riffling through Revelation when I had one. A revelation, I mean. It must have been the flying numbers racing by before my eyes at dizzying speed. Perhaps not, but something in my freshly attentive brain went click, as clearly audible, inside my head at least, as the slow breathing of the ancient oaken beams above my head. For an instant, I felt as if I myself had swallowed cyanide. My mouth went dry, and my breath snagged in my throat. Slowly, so as not to break the spell, I reached into my pocket and pulled out the crumpled bit of paper I had found in Orlando's pocket. The numbers danced before my eyes. 54, 6, 7, 8, 9. I had supposed them at first to be the numbers of hymns, but I was wrong. What if they were books, chapters, and verses? With trembling hands, I turned to the general index. Beginning with Genesis, I counted off the entries. The 54th book of the Bible was the first epistle of Paul the Apostle to Timothy. I followed my finger to chapter 6 and then to verses 7, 8, and 9. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therefore content. But they that will be rich fall into temptation, and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. A passage about drowning found in the pocket of a drowned man? It was beyond coincidence. But what did it mean? Could it have been a warning, a threat? And if it was, who gave it or sent it to Orlando, and how did it come to be in his pocket? I read the remaining lines of Timothy, which, although they were few, contained the famous saying that the love of money is the root of all evil, and that those who covet it have pierced themselves through with arrows. Poor Orlando was fortunate in a way, that whoever had it in for him hadn't used a crossbow. But what had it all to do with money? As far as I knew, Orlando had been as poor as a church mouse, brought up by a rural clergyman who had to embezzle funds from the collection plate in order to heat the vicarage. There were so many unanswered questions. Why, for instance, had someone chosen St. Paul's first epistle to Timothy as a warning? Surely there were many much more threatening passages in the Old Testament, such as those in which God is shaking his fist at Moses and his tribes. Could it be that the Timothy letter was the only reference in the entire Bible to drowning? If that was the case, it would prove beyond a doubt that Orlando's killing was meditated. It takes a certain amount of calculation to select a biblical text and then plan and execute a murder to match. It would have been too much to ask, too much of a coincidence, for the fat black volume in my hands to contain a Bible concordance, and of course it did not. I would need to get my hands on one of these at the earliest possible moment to check out the drowning angle. Again I opened the pages of Annie Cray's Bible in search of inspiration. Anything would do. I needed help. Like the attached Bible, the Book of Common Prayer contained a great deal of reference material, a calendar of the church year, including the various saints' days, a table of the movable feasts according to the several days that Easter can possibly fall upon, a complicated set of tables of rules for finding the golden number, and, once having found it, determining the date of Easter in any given year. It was like a holy treasure hunt. Fortunately, I had learned something about the topic from our own vicar, Denwin Richardson in Bishop's Lacey, who, having caught me fishing, illegally, in the river behind St. Tancred's, had sat down beside me in the warm summer grass and begun rattling on about one of his greatest enthusiasms, the Book of Common Prayer and how to use it. He had delivered several sermons upon the topic, not only from the pulpit, but also at various meetings and functions in the parish hall. If there was a single topic which the Anglican parishioners of Bishop's Lacey were prepared to be quizzed upon at the Golden Gate, it was the Book of Common Prayer. Not only were there charts and tables of the saints' days and holy days, but also complex decrees about which chapters and verses of the Old and New Testaments were to be read aloud as lessons, depending upon the calendar and the time of day. "It may seem rather left-handed," Denwin had said, "but it's all perfectly logical. It all comes down to the moon, Flavia, when you stop to think about it." Which, I suppose, is as good a thing to base a religion upon as any. But just when I thought I had wrapped my mind around the codes and calendars of Christian prayer, Denwin had mentioned, almost apologetically, that there was also an alternative table of lessons, and it was this which we used at St. Tancred's, rather than the original. "But why?" I asked. "Because the bishop wishes it," he had said, slipping me a furtive wink after a hasty glance round to make sure that no one was watching. "So there it is, then," I remember thinking. "Down here on earth, a bishop is mightier than the moon." Although this was an obvious case of misguided thinking, I did not say so to Denwin. The poor man had a living to earn. I dragged my mind back to the present, to the alternative tables. If St. Mildred's in the Marsh used the same timetables we used in Bishop's Lacey, I ought to have an answer in two flicks of a dead lamb's tail. Timothy 1 ought to be easy enough to spot. I let my eyes float slowly down the long columns like a deflating balloon, beginning with the first Sunday in Advent, which, of course, would be in December, then onward through Christmas, Epiphany, Lent, and Easter. Surprisingly, Timothy did not make his appearance until several Sundays after Trinity, at which time he was taken out for a rather good trot. Ah, here he was. 1 Timothy, chapter 6, verses 7 to 9. The very verses I had found listed in the dead Orlando's pocket. My blood was already beginning to jingle. with the knowledge absorbed during Denwin's Riverside lecture, as well as various exposures at Girl Guide meetings, I was able to work out, with remarkable speed and efficiency, the precise date of that reading in the present year of our Lord, 1952. But they that will be rich fall into temptation, and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. Those now chilling words would be read aloud from the lectern as the second lesson of Evensong on the third Sunday after Trinity. Here, at this very spot, they would echo among these very stones and hammer beams. June the 29th. Tomorrow evening. The first Sunday, and just 2 days, after I fished Orlando Whitbread's drowned body out of the river. Had it been planned? Was this a message, or a warning to others, from Orlando's killer? Chapter 19. The time had come to shrug off the mantle of the present, as Daffy puts it, when she's reading her beloved Dickens, and project myself 2 years into the past to the morning of the three earlier murders. The successful solving of any crime depends, more than anything, upon accurate reconstruction, which is the closest thing we have in the modern world to time travel. Most detectives wouldn't admit that it's a form of self-hypnosis, but they have their reputations to think of. Think how the court would laugh, even the magistrate on the bench in his wig and robes, if the detective, asked how he came to a certain conclusion, replied, "I put myself in a trance, m'lud." There wouldn't be a dry eye in the house. I squirmed and settled myself into the pew, closed my eyes, and folded my hands daintily in my lap. In my mind, I let the pages of the calendar tear loose and fly away, one by one, month by month. June of 1952 became May, then April, and so forth. Christmas flew by, and I was back in 1951. November, October, September, the months of summer, spring, then Christmas again. It was 1950. I allowed the pages to slow a little. I didn't want to overshoot. August, July, June, and here we were. I took a deep breath and slowly opened my eyes. The church was the same as it always had been, but then it would be, wouldn't it? There was a stir of air behind me as the door opened and the three Graces entered, Grace Willoughby, Grace Harcourt, and Annie Cray, looking much as I remembered them from the grainy photographs on the front pages of the tabloid newspapers, except that now their faces were in colour. Grace Willoughby, as tall and slender as her name, was wearing a smart black tailored suit with a cameo brooch at her throat, and had perched on her head a curved wing-like thing, which looked as if it had been forcibly detached from a duck. Grace Harcourt, somewhat shorter and broad-shouldered, with greyish-blonde hair, wore a summer dress of dusky rose and a smart straw hat, while Annie Cray, dark, short, and squat, and rather toad-like, I thought, uncharitably, seeing as she was dead, had draped herself in a kind of loose rug or blanket, in which holes had been cut out for her head and arms. A floppy-brimmed black hat gave her the appearance of a villain in a cowboy film. I slid over to make room for them as they entered the pew. Even though the poor creatures couldn't see me, I didn't want to be caught staring. More footsteps at the rear and the clatter of kneeling benches announced the arrival of Mr. and Mrs. Farnsworth, Lettice and Hugo, and moments later the much lighter footfall of Hob Nightingale. Because of the summer season and the sparseness of the congregation, there would be no processional this morning, no choir, no organ, just the bare bones, so to speak. As far as I knew, the entire cast of characters, with the exception of Canon Whitbread, had now taken up their positions to act out the tragedy. And now, yes, here comes Canon Whitbread, hurrying in from the vestry, late for the service, just as Claire had told me he had been, and empty-handed, which meant that the wine and wafers were already in the tabernacle on the altar. In my mind, I lit a flame in the altar lamp to indicate that fact. I would need to check these details later with the witnesses, of course, but lighting a flame with the mind is a powerful aid to understanding. The canon genuflected before the altar, and without further ado, launched into the Holy Communion service. With my acute hearing, I could actually hear his dusty words. After the Lord's Prayer, he began to collect. Almighty God, unto whom all hearts be open, all desires known, and from whom no secrets are hid. What had Almighty God seen that morning, I wondered, as he looked into the secret hearts and desires of those three women who were about to die, and into the heart of the clergyman who was about to murder them. Now Canon Whitbread had begun the recital of the Ten Commandments. Well, there was no need to recreate the entire service. The part I was most interested in wouldn't come until near the end. In my mind, I sped up the action, so that Canon Whitbread was racing through the order of service like the Keystone Cops. It might have been funny if it hadn't been murder. I waited until he and the little congregation dropped to their knees for the general confession, then reduced the speed to normal. Turning to face the people, Canon Whitbread now begged God to pardon and deliver them from all their sins, confirm and strengthen them in all goodness, and bring them to everlasting life. As he did so, I was able for the first time to study his face. My immediate impression was that the man was tired, that he had been awake for much of the night. One of his eyelids twitched incessantly, the other seemed to droop a little. The hollows of his rather gaunt face showed up as shadows, his chin and cheeks darkened with new whiskers. There had been an unsuccessful attempt to hide the morning's bristles with a rose-tinted talcum powder. He had not taken the time to shave. My second impression was that this was not the countenance of a killer. I had several times come face to face with killers. Not one of them had had the gentle features of this rather worried-looking man. I was recalling his face, of course, from the dozens of black-and-white photographs I had seen in the newspapers, but never until now did it ever occur to me that an innocent man might have been sent to the gallows. The very thought of it caused my blood to bubble. I focused my attention on the hands of the man at the altar. Having transformed the host and the wine into the body and blood of Christ, Canon Whitbread genuflected deeply and administered communion to himself, consuming the broken host and draining the chalice. I knew already that there was no danger of his poisoning himself, that he would go on living until the day he died at the hands of the hangman. But now he was turning again to the altar, turning his back upon those of us seated in the pews. I watched, transfixed, as he brought reverently out from the tabernacle the silver vessel, the ciborium which contained the wafers. I could hardly believe it. They had been there all night. I froze the action to let my mind catch up. Normally, with a decent attendance, Canon Whitbread would have consecrated only as many of the hosts as were needed. Any remaining would be kept in the tabernacle for use during the week, including visitation of the sick and so forth. But this morning, with only a handful in attendance, he would make use of the hosts that were already consecrated. Of course, he had newly consecrated one of the larger wafers for his own consumption, but the rest of the congregation would be given the leftovers, so to speak. The point was this. The hosts and the wine, which were about to be administered to the unsuspecting congregation, had been left in an unlocked church overnight, and perhaps even longer. Anyone in England, and perhaps even beyond, could have sneaked in the old cyanide. This case was becoming far more difficult than I could ever have imagined. I needed to find out, and as quickly as possible, whether the poison had been contained in the wine, or the wafers, or both. With mounting horror, and, I must admit, with mounting excitement, I watched as he turned to face us. Annie, who had been last into the pew, was already hoisting herself to her feet and shuffling sideways into the aisle. In her mind, there was probably some imagined heavenly prize for being first at the rail. Well, she'd soon find out, I thought. The two remaining Graces, Harcourt and Willoughby, were breathing down her neck. I slowed the image down a little. I didn't want to miss a single detail. It flashed briefly into my mind that I could stop their motion and reverse it like a comic film, but I quickly dismissed the idea. I could only make them walk backward out of the church and home again, bottoms first. I could not really change what had already happened. I was unable to save these three women from a certain death. "These are but shadows of the things that have been," as the ghost of Christmas past told Ebenezer Scrooge. I could not change their destiny. I might as well sit back and learn from it. Now they had reached the rail and were kneeling. Grace Willoughby, in spite of being the last at the communion rail, was the first to receive the host from the hands of Canon Whitbread. She crossed herself rather showily. Now it was the turn of Grace Harcourt, and finally Annie Cray. Even though Annie's back was still toward me, I could tell by the sudden slump of her shoulders that she was miffed, as first place in heaven was snatched unfairly out of her grasp. And now for the wine, or should I say the blood of Christ? It all depended whether you accepted the hotly disputed doctrine of transubstantiation, the actual transformation of fermented grape juice into the holy blood of the Son of God. It was a subject upon which I had already come to my own conclusions. 6 months ago, at a greatly trying time in my life, and racked by loss of faith, I had whisked away, by a method which I'm still ashamed to reveal, a sample of the consecrated wine from Holy Communion at St. Tancred's, and taken it home to my laboratory, where I had subjected the supposedly holy liquid to the most rigorous analysis known to organic chemistry. I had compared the fluid and its constituents at various stages of my experiment with control samples of the ordinary or unconsecrated wine nicked from the same church, I must confess, at a somewhat earlier date. I had recorded the results, which were indisputable, in the back pages of one of Uncle Tarquin's bulging notebooks, to be discovered at some future date when the world is better prepared to receive my earth-shattering findings. I forced my mind back from these researches to St. Mildred's, in the imminent demise of the Three Graces. Because there were no deacons in attendance to assist with the Holy Communion on this sunny summer morning, it was left to Canon Whitbread himself to deliver both bread and wine, and I had to admire the quiet efficiency with which he administered the hosts to each of the three communicants before returning briefly to the altar to replace the ciborium in the tabernacle and to take up the chalice. And now, here it was, the moment I'd been waiting for. I took a mental snapshot of the scene. Canon Whitbread stood poised, chalice in hand, facing the three communicants whose heads were bowed in preparation. I felt a shiver run down the back of my neck, down my arms and into my elbows. I was about to witness murder. but whether Canon Whitbread was the killer or not, I could not yet tell. And yet he was certainly the instrument by which cruel fate